jump then if you want. Make yourself into a claw. It will do you no good. Come on, he thought, and looked down into the dark water at the slant of the line. Eat it now, and it will strengthen the hand. It is not the hand's fault, and you have been many hours with a fish. But you can stay with him forever. Eat the bonita now. He picked up a piece and put it in his mouth and chewed it slowly. It was not unpleasant. Chew it well, he thought, and get all the juices. It would not be bad to eat with a little lime or with lemon or with salt. How do you feel, hand? He asked the cramped hand that was almost as stiff as rigor mortis. I'll eat some more for you. He ate the other part of the piece that he had cut in two. He chewed it carefully and then spat out the skin. How does it go, hand? Or is it too early to know? He took another full piece and chewed it. It is a strong, full-blooded fish, he thought. I was lucky to get him instead of a dolphin. Dolphin is too sweet. This is hardly sweet at all, and all the strength is still in it. There is no sense in being anything but practical, though, he thought. I wish I had some salt, and I do not know whether the sun will rot or dry what is left, so I had better eat it all, though I am not hungry. The fish is calm and steady. I will eat it all, and then I will be ready. Be patient, hand, he said. I do this for you. I wish I could feed the fish, he thought. He is my brother, but I must kill him and keep strong to do it. Slowly and conscientiously, he ate all of the wedge-shaped strips of fish. He straightened up, wiping his hand on his trousers. Now, he said, you can let the cord go, hand, and I will handle him with the right arm alone until you stop that nonsense. He put his left foot on the heavy line that the left hand had held, and lay back against the pull, against his back. God help me to have the cramp go, he said, because I do not know what the fish is going to do. But he seems calm, he thought, and following his plan. But what is his plan, he thought? And what is mine? Mine I must improvise to his because of his great size. If he will jump, I can kill him. But he stays down forever. Then I will stay down with him forever. He rubbed his cramped hand against his trousers and tried to gentle the fingers, but it would not open. Maybe it will open with the sun, he thought. Maybe it will open when the strong raw tuna is digested. If I have to have it, I will open it, cost whatever it costs. But I do not want to open it now by force. Let it open by itself and come back of its own accord. After all, I abused it much in the night when it was necessary to free and untie the various lines. He looked across the sea and knew how alone he was now. But he could see the prisms in the dark, deep water, and the line stretching ahead and the strange undulation of the calm. The clouds were building up now for the trade wind, and he looked ahead and saw a flight of wild ducks etching themselves against the sky over the water, then blurring, then etching again, and he knew no man was ever alone on the sea. He thought of how some men feared being out of sight of land in a small boat, and knew they were right in the months of sudden bad weather, but now they were in hurricane months, and when there are no hurricanes, the weather of hurricane months is the best of all the year. If there is a hurricane, you always see the signs of it in the sky for days ahead if you are at sea. They do not see it ashore because they do not know what to look for, he thought. The land must make a difference, too, in the shape of the clouds. But we have no hurricane coming now. He looked at the sky and saw the white cumulus built like friendly piles of ice cream, and high above them were the thin feathers of the cirrus against the high September sky. Light brisa, he said. Better weather for me than for you, fish. His left hand was still cramped, but he was unknotting it slowly. I hate a cramp, he thought. It is a treachery of one's own body. It is humiliating before others to have a diarrhea from ptomaine poisoning or to vomit from it. But a cramp, he thought of it as a calambre, humiliates oneself, especially when one is alone. If the boy were here, He would rub it for me and loosen it down from the forearm, he thought. But it will loosen up. Then with his right hand he felt the difference in the pull of the line before he saw the slant change in the water. Then, as he leaned against the line and slapped his left hand hard and fast against his thigh, he saw the line slanting slowly upward. "He's coming up," he said. "Come on, hand, please come on." The line rose slowly and steadily, and then the surface of the ocean bulged ahead of the boat, and the fish came out. He came out unendingly, and the water poured from his sides. He was bright in the sun, and his head and back were dark purple, and in the sun the stripes on his side showed wide and a light lavender. His sword was as long as a baseball bat, and tapered like a rapier, and he rose his full length from the water, and then he re-entered it smoothly, like a diver. And the old man saw the great scythe blade of his tail go under, and the line commenced to race out. "He is 2 feet longer than the skiff," the old man said. The line was going out fast but steadily, and the fish was not panicked. The old man was trying with both hands to keep the line just inside of breaking strength. He knew that if he could not slow the fish with a steady pressure, the fish could take all the line and break it. "He is a great fish, and I must convince him," he thought. "I must never let him learn his strength nor what he could do if he made his run. If I were him, I would put in everything now and go until something broke. But thank God they are not as intelligent as we who kill them, although they are more noble and more able." The old man had seen many great fish. He had seen many that weighed more than 1,000 pounds, and he had caught 2 of that size in his life, but never alone. Now, alone, and out of sight of land, he was fast to the biggest fish that he had ever seen, and bigger than he had ever heard of, and his left hand was still as tight as the gripped claws of an eagle. "It will uncramp, though," he thought. "Surely it will uncramp to help my right hand. There are 3 things that are brothers, the fish and my 2 hands. It must uncramp. It is unworthy of it to be cramped." The fish had slowed again and was going at his usual pace. "I wonder why he jumped," the old man thought. "He jumped almost as though to show me how big he was. I know now, anyway," he thought. "I wish I could show him what sort of a man I am. But then he would see the cramped hand. Let him think I am more man than I am, and I will be so. I wish I was the fish," he thought, "with everything he has against only my will and my intelligence." He settled comfortably against the wood and took his suffering as it came, and the fish swam steadily, and the boat moved slowly through the dark water. There was a small sea rising with the wind coming up from the east, and at noon the old man's left hand was uncramped. "Bad news for you, fish," he said, and shifted the line over the sacks that covered his shoulders. He was comfortable but suffering, although he did not admit the suffering at all. "I'm not religious," he said, "but I will say 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys that I should catch this fish. And I promise to make a pilgrimage to the Virgin of Cobre if I catch him. That is a promise." He commenced to say his prayers mechanically. Sometimes he would be so tired that he could not remember the prayer, and then he would say them fast so that they would come automatically. "Hail Marys are easier to say than Our Fathers," he thought. "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen." Then he added, "Blessed Virgin, pray for the death of this fish, wonderful though he is." With his prayers said, and feeling much better, but suffering exactly as much, and perhaps a little more, he leaned against the wood of the bow and began mechanically to work the fingers of his left hand. The sun was hot now, although the breeze was rising gently. "I had better rebait that little line out over the stern," he said. "If the fish decides to stay another night, I will need to eat again, and the water is low in the bottle. I don't think I can get anything but a dolphin here. But if I eat him fresh enough, he won't be bad. I wish a flying fish would come on board tonight. But I have no light to attract them. A flying fish is excellent to eat raw, and I would not have to cut him up. I must save all my strength now. Christ, I did not know he was so big. I'll kill him, though, he said, in all his greatness and his glory. Although it is unjust, he thought. But I will show him what a man can do and what a man endures. I told the boy I was a strange old man, he said. Now is when I must prove it. The thousand times that he had proved it meant nothing. Now he was proving it again. Each time was a new time, and he never thought about the past when he was doing it. I wish he'd sleep and I could sleep and dream about the lions, he thought. Why are the lions the main thing that is left? Don't think, old man, he said to himself. Rest gently now against the wood and think of nothing. He is working. Work as little as you can. It was getting into the afternoon and the boat still moved slowly and steadily, but there was an added drag now from the easterly breeze, and the old man rowed gently with the small sea, and the hurt of the cord across his back came to him easily and smoothly. Once in the afternoon the line started to rise again, but the fish only continued to swim at a slightly higher level. The sun was on the old man's left arm and shoulder and on his back, so he knew the fish had turned east of north. Now that he had seen him once, he could picture the fish swimming in the water with his purple pectoral fins set wide as wings and the great erect tail slicing through the dark. I wonder how much he sees at that depth, the old man thought. His eye is huge, and a horse with much less eye can see in the dark. Once I could see quite well in the dark, not in the absolute dark, but almost as a cat sees. The sun and his steady movement of his fingers had uncramped his left hand now completely, and he began to shift more of the strain to it, and he shrugged the muscles of his back to shift the hurt of the cord a little. If you're not tired, fish, he said aloud, you must be very strange. He felt tired now, and he knew the night would come soon, and he tried to think of other things. He thought of the big leagues. To him they were the Gran Ligas. And he knew that the Yankees of New York were playing the Tigres of Detroit. This is the second day now that I do not know the result of the Hugos, he thought. But I must have confidence, and I must be worthy of the great DiMaggio who does all things perfectly, even with the pain of the bone spur in his heel. What is a bone spur, he asked himself. Un espuela de hueso. We do not have them. Can it be as painful as the spur of a fighting cock in one's heel? I do not think I could endure that. Or the loss of the eye and of both eyes and continue to fight as the fighting cocks do. Man is not much beside the great birds and beasts. Still, I would rather be that beast down there in the darkness of the sea. Unless the sharks come, he said aloud. If sharks come, God pity him. And me. Do you believe the great DiMaggio would stay with the fish as long as I will stay with this one, he thought. I'm sure he would. And more, since he is young and strong. Also his father was a fisherman. But would the bone spur hurt him too much? I do not know, he said aloud. I never had a bone spur. As the sun set, he remembered to give himself more confidence. The time in the tavern at Casablanca, when he had played the hand game with the great Negro from Cienfuegos, who was the strongest man on the docks. They had gone one day and one night with their elbows on a chalk line on the table, and their forearms straight up and their hands gripped tight. Each one was trying to force the other's hand down onto the table. There was much bedding, and people went in and out of the room under the kerosene lights, and he had looked at the arm and hand of the Negro, and at the Negro's face. They changed the referees every 4 hours after the first eight so that the referees could sleep. Blood came out from under the fingernails of both his and the Negro's hands, and they looked each other in the eye and at their hands and forearms, and the bettors went in and out of the room and sat on high chairs against the wall and watched. The walls were painted bright blue and were of wood, and the lamps threw their shadows against them. The Negro's shadow was huge, and it moved on the wall as the breeze moved the lamps. The odds would change back and forth all night, and they fed the Negro rum and lighted cigarettes for him. Then the Negro, after the rum, would try for a tremendous effort. And once he had the old man, who was not an old man then, but was Santiago el Campeón, nearly 3 inches off balance. But the old man had raised his hand up to a dead even again. He was sure then that he had the Negro, who was a fine man and a great athlete, beaten. And at daylight, when the bettors were asking that it be called a draw, and the referee was shaking his head, he had unleashed his effort and forced the hand of the Negro down and down until it rested on the wood. The match had started on a Sunday morning, and it ended on a Monday morning. Many of the bettors had asked for a draw because they had to go to work on the docks loading sacks of sugar or at the Havana Coal Company. Otherwise, everyone would have wanted it to go to a finish. But he had finished it anyway, and before anyone had to go to work. For a long time after that, everyone had called him the champion, and there had been a return match in the spring. But not much money was bet, and he had won it quite easily, since he had broken the confidence of the Negro from Cienfuegos in the first match. After that, he had a few matches, and then no more. He decided that he could beat anyone if he wanted to badly enough, and he decided that it was bad for his right hand for fishing. He had tried a few practice matches with his left hand, but his left hand had always been a traitor and would not do what he called on it to do, and he did not trust it. The sun will bake it out well now, he thought. It should not cramp on me again unless it gets too cold in the night. I wonder what this night will bring. An airplane passed overhead on its course to Miami, and he watched its shadow scaring up schools of flying fish. With so much flying fish, there should be dolphin, he said, and he leaned back on the line to see if it was possible to gain any on his fish. But he could not, and it stayed at the hardness and water drop shivering that preceded breaking. The boat moved ahead slowly, and he watched the airplane until he could no longer see it. It must be very strange in an airplane, he thought. I wonder what the sea looks like from that height. They should be able to see fish well if they do not fly too high. I would like to fly very slowly at 200 fathoms high and see the fish from above. In the turtle boats I was in the cross trees of the masthead, and even at that height I saw much. The dolphin looked greener from there, and you can see their stripes and their purple spots, and you can see all of the school as they swim. Why is it that all fast-moving fish of the dark current have purple backs and usually purple stripes or spots? The dolphin looks green, of course, because he is really golden, but when he comes to feed, truly hungry, purple stripes show on his sides as on a marlin. Can it be anger? Or the greater speed he makes that brings them out? Just before it was dark, as they passed a great island of sargasso weed that heaved and swung in the light sea as though the ocean were making love with something under a yellow blanket, his small line was taken by a dolphin. He saw it first when it jumped in the air, true gold in the last of the sun and bending and flapping wildly in the air. It jumped again and again in the acrobatics of its fear, and he worked his way back to the stern and crouching and holding the big line with his right hand and arm. He pulled the dolphin in with his left hand, stepping on the gained line each time with his bare left foot. When the fish was at the stern, plunging and cutting from side to side in desperation, the old man leaned over the stern and lifted the burnished gold fish with its purple spots over the stern. Its jaws were working convulsively in quick bites against the hook, and it pounded the bottom of the skiff with its long, flat body, its tail and its head, until he clubbed it across the shining golden head until it shivered and was still. The old man unhooked the fish, rebaited the line with another sardine, and tossed it over. Then he worked his way slowly back to the bow. He washed his left hand and wiped it on his trousers. Then he shifted the heavy line from his right hand to his left and washed his right hand in the sea while he watched the sun go into the ocean and the slant of the big cord. He hasn't changed at all, he said. But watching the movement of the water against his hand, he noted that it was perceptibly slower. I'll lash the two oars together against the stern, and that will slow him in the night. He's good for the night, and so am I. It would be better to gut the dolphin a little later to save the blood and the meat, he thought. I can do that a little later and lash the oars to make a drag at the same time. I'd better keep the fish quiet now and not disturb him too much at sunset. The setting of the sun is a difficult time for all fish. He let his hand dry in the air, then grasped the line with it and eased himself as much as he could, and allowed himself to be pulled forward against the wood, so that the boat took the strain as much or more than he did. I'm learning how to do it, he thought. This part of it, anyway. Then, too, remember he hasn't eaten since he took the bait, and he is huge and needs much food. I have eaten the whole bonito. Tomorrow I will eat the dolphin. He called it dorado. Perhaps I should eat some of it when I clean it. It will be harder to eat than the bonito. But then, nothing is easy. How do you feel, fish? He asked aloud. I feel good and my left hand is better and I have food for a night and a day. Pull the boat, fish. He did not truly feel good because the pain from the cord across his back had almost passed pain and gone into a dullness that he mistrusted. But I have had worse things than that, he thought. My hand is only cut a little, and the cramp is gone from the other. My legs are all right. Also now I have gained on him in the question of sustenance. It was dark now, as it becomes dark quickly after the sun sets in September. He lay against the worn wood of the bow and rested all that he could. The first stars were out. He did not know the name of Rigel, but he saw it and knew soon they would all be out, and he would have all his distant friends. The fish is my friend, too, he said aloud. I have never seen or heard of such a fish, but I must kill him. I'm glad we do not have to try to kill the stars. Imagine if each day a man must try to kill the moon, he thought. The moon runs away. But imagine if a man each day should have to try to kill the sun. We were born lucky, he thought. Then he was sorry for the great fish that had nothing to eat, and his determination to kill him never relaxed in his sorrow for him. How many people will he feed, he thought. But are they worthy to eat him? No, of course not. There is no one worthy of eating him from the manner of his behavior and his great dignity. I do not understand these things, he thought, but it is good that we do not have to try to kill the sun or the moon or the stars. It is enough to live on the sea and kill our true brothers. Now, he thought, I must think about the drag. It has its perils and its merits. I may lose so much line that I will lose him. If he makes his effort and the drag made by the oars is in place and the boat loses all her lightness. Her lightness prolongs both our suffering, but it is my safety, since he has great speed that he has never yet employed. No matter what passes, I must gut the dolphin so he does not spoil and eat some of him to be strong. Now I will rest an hour more and feel that he is solid and steady before I move back to the stern to do the work and make the decision. In the meantime, I can see how he acts and if he shows any changes. The oars are a good trick, but it has reached the time to play for safety. He is much fish still. And I saw that hook was in the corner of his mouth, and he kept his mouth tight shut. The punishment of the hook is nothing. The punishment of hunger, and that he is against something that he does not comprehend, is everything. Rest now, old man, and let him work until your next duty comes. He rested for what he believed to be 2 hours. The moon did not rise now until late, and he had no way of judging the time. Nor was he really resting, except comparatively. He was still bearing the pull of the fish across his shoulders, but he placed his left hand on the gunwale of the bow and confided more and more the resistance to the fish to the skiff itself. How simple it would be if I could make the line fast, he thought. But with one small lurch he could break it. I must cushion the pull of the line with my body, and at all times be ready to give line with both hands. "But you have not slept yet, old man," he said aloud. "It is half a day and a night, and now another day, and you have not slept. You must devise a way so that you sleep a little if he is quiet and steady. If you do not sleep, you might become unclear in the head." I'm clear enough in the head, he thought. Too clear. I'm as clear as the stars that are my brother's. Still, I must sleep. They sleep, and the moon and the sun sleep, and even the ocean sleeps sometimes on certain days when there is no current and a flat calm. But remember to sleep, he thought. Make yourself do it and devise some simple and sure way about the lines. Now go back and prepare the dolphin. It is too dangerous to rig the oars as a drag if you must sleep. I could go without sleeping, he told himself, but it would be too dangerous. He started to work his way back to the stern on his hands and knees, being careful not to jerk against the fish. He may be half asleep himself, he thought, but I do not want him to rest. He must pull until he dies. Back in the stern, he turned so that his left hand held the strain of the line across his shoulders and drew his knife from its sheath with his right hand. The stars were bright now, and he saw the dolphin clearly, and he pushed the blade of his knife into his head and drew him out from under the stern. He put one of his feet on the fish and slit him quickly from the vent up to the tip of his lower jaw. Then he put his knife down and gutted him with his right hand, scooping him clean and spilling the gills clear. He felt the maw heavy and slippery in his hands, and he slid it open. There were two flying fish inside. They were fresh and hard, and he laid them side by side and dropped the guts and the gills over the stern. They sank, leaving a trail of phosphorescence in the water. The dolphin was cold, and a leprous gray-white now in the starlight, and the old man skinned one side of him while he held his foot on the fish's head. Then he turned him over and skinned the other side, and cut each side off from the head down to the tail. He slid the carcass overboard and looked to see if there was any swirl in the water, but there was only the light of its slow descent. He turned then and placed the two flying fish inside the two fillets of fish, and, putting his knife back in its sheath, he worked his way slowly back to the bow. His back was bent with the weight of the line across it, and he carried the fish in his right hand. Back in the bow, he laid the two fillets of fish out on the wood with the flying fish beside them. After that, he settled the line across his shoulders in a new place and held it again with his left hand resting on the gunwale. Then he leaned over the side and washed the flying fish in the water, noting the speed of the water against his hand. His hand was phosphorescent from skinning the fish, and he watched the flow of the water against it. The flow was less strong, and as he rubbed the side of his hand against the planking of the skiff, particles of phosphorus floated off and drifted slowly astern. "He is tiring, or he is resting," the old man said. "Now let me get through the eating of this dolphin and get some rest and a little sleep." Under the stars and with the night colder all the time, he ate half of one of the dolphin fillets and one of the flying fish, gutted and with its head off. "What an excellent fish dolphin is to eat cooked," he said. "And what a miserable fish raw. I will never go in a boat again without salt or limes. If I had brains, I would have splashed water on the bow all day, and drying it would have made salt," he thought. "But then I did not hook the dolphin until almost sunset. Still, it was lack of preparation. But I have chewed it all well, and I am not nauseated." The sky was clouding over to the east, and one after another the stars he knew were gone. It looked now as though he were moving into a great canyon of clouds and the wind had dropped. "There will be bad weather in 3 or 4 days," he said, "but not tonight and not tomorrow. Rig now to get some sleep, old man, while the fish is calm and steady." He held the line tight in his right hand and then pushed his thigh against his right hand as he leaned all his weight against the wood of the bow. Then he passed the line a little lower on his shoulders and braced his left hand on it. "My right hand can hold it as long as it is braced," he thought. "If it relaxes in sleep, my left hand will wake me as the line goes out. It is hard on the right hand, but he is used to punishment. Even if I sleep 20 minutes or a half an hour, it is good." He lay forward, cramping himself against the line with all of his body, putting all his weight onto his right hand, and he was asleep. He did not dream of the lions, but instead of a vast school of porpoises that stretched for 8 or 10 miles, and it was in the time of their mating, and they would leap high into the air and return into the same hole they had made in the water when they leaped. Then he dreamed that he was in the village on his bed, and there was a norther, and he was very cold, and his right arm was asleep because his head had rested on it instead of a pillow. After that he began to dream of the long yellow beach, and he saw the first of the lions come down onto it in the early dark, and then the other lions came, and he rested his chin on the wood of the bows where the ship lay anchored with the evening offshore breeze, and he waited to see if there would be more lions, and he was happy. The moon had been up for a long time, but he slept on, and the fish pulled on steadily, and the boat moved into the tunnel of clouds. He woke with the jerk of his right fist coming up against his face and the line burning out through his right hand. He had no feeling in his left hand, but he braked all he could with his right, and the line rushed out. Finally, his left hand found the line, and he leaned back against the line, and now it burned his back and his left hand was taking all the strain and cutting badly. He looked back at the coils of line, and they were feeding smoothly. Just then, the fish jumped, making a great bursting of the ocean and then a heavy fall. Then he jumped again and again, and the boat was going fast, although the line was still racing out, and the old man was raising the strain to a breaking point, and raising it to breaking point again and again. He had been pulled down tight onto the bow, and his face was in the cut slice of dolphin, and he could not move. "This is what we waited for," he thought. "So now let us take it." "Make him pay for the line," he thought. "Make him pay for it." He could not see the fish's jumps, but only heard the breaking of the ocean and the heavy splash as he fell. The speed of the line was cutting his hands badly, but he had always known this would happen, and he tried to keep the cutting across the calloused parts and not let the line slip into the palm nor cut the fingers. If the boy was here, he would wet the coils of line, he thought. Yes, if the boy were here. If the boy were here. The line went out and out and out, but it was slowing now, and he was making the fish earn each inch of it. Now he got his head up from the wood and out of the slice of fish that his cheek had crushed. Then he was on his knees, and then he rose slowly to his feet. He was seeding the line, but more slowly all the time. He worked back to where he could feel with his foot the coils of line that he could not see. There was plenty of line still, and now the fish had to pull the friction of all that new line through the water. Yes, he thought, and now he has jumped more than a dozen times and filled the sacks along his back with air, and he cannot go down deep to die where I cannot bring him up. He will start circling soon, and then I must work on him. I wonder what started him so suddenly. Could it have been hunger that made him desperate? Or was he frightened by something in the night? Maybe he suddenly felt fear. But he was such a strong, calm fish, and he seemed so fearless and so confident. It is strange. "You better be fearless and confident yourself, old man," he said. "You're holding him again, but you cannot get line." But soon he has to circle. The old man held him with his left hand and his shoulders now, and he stooped down and scooped up water in his right hand to get the crushed dolphin flesh off of his face. He was afraid that it might nauseate him, and he would vomit and lose his strength. When his face was cleaned, he washed his right hand in the water over the side, and then let it stay in the salt water while he watched the first light come before the sunrise. He's headed almost east, he thought. That means he is tired and going with the current. Soon he will have to circle. Then our true work begins. After he judged that his right hand had been in the water long enough, he took it out and looked at it. "It's not bad," he said, "and pain does not matter to a man." He took hold of the line carefully so that it did not fit into any of the fresh line cuts, and shifted his weight so that he could put his left hand into the sea on the other side of the skiff. "You did not do so badly for something worthless," he said to his left hand. "But there was a moment when I could not find you." Why was I not born with two good hands, he thought. Perhaps it was my fault in not training that one properly. But God knows he has had enough chances to learn. He did not do so badly in the night, though, and he has only cramped once. If he cramps again, let the line cut him off. When he thought that, he knew that he was not being clear-headed, and he thought he should choose some more of the dolphin. But I can't, he told himself. It is better to be light-headed than to lose your strength from nausea, and I know I cannot keep it if I eat it, since my face was in it. I will keep it for an emergency until it goes bad. But it is too late to try for strength now through nourishment. Oh, you stupid, he told himself. Eat the other flying fish. It was there, cleaned and ready, and he picked it up with his left hand and ate it, chewing bones carefully and eating all of it down to the tail. It has more nourishment than almost any fish, he thought. At least the kind of strength that I need. Now I have done what I can, he thought. Let him begin to circle and let the fight come. The sun was rising for the third time since he had put to sea when the fish started to circle. He could not see by the slant of the line that the fish was circling. It was too early for that. He just felt a faint slackening of the pressure of the line, and he commenced to pull on it gently with his right hand. It tightened, as always. But just when he reached the point where it would break, line began to come in. He slipped his shoulders and head from under the line and began to pull in line steadily and gently. He used both of his hands in a swinging motion, and tried to do the pulling as much as he could with his body and his legs. His old legs and shoulders pivoted with the swinging of the pulling. It's a very big circle, he said, but he is circling. Then the line would not come in anymore, and he held it until he saw the drops jumping from it in the sun. Then it started out, and the old man knelt down and let it go grudgingly back into the dark water. He's making the far part of his circle now, he said. I must hold all I can, he thought. The strain will shorten his circle each time. Perhaps in an hour I will see him. Now I must convince him, and then I must kill him. But the fish kept on circling slowly, and the old man was wet with sweat and tired deep into his bones 2 hours later. But the circles were much shorter now, and from the way the line slanted he could tell the fish had risen steadily while he swam. For an hour the old man had been seeing black spots before his eyes, and the sweat salted his eyes and salted the cut over his eye and on his forehead. He was not afraid of the black spots. They were normal at the tension that he was pulling on the line. Twice, though, he had felt faint and dizzy, and that had worried him. I could not fail myself and die on a fish like this, he said. Now that I have him coming so beautifully, God help me endure. I'll say 100 Our Fathers and 100 Hail Marys, but I cannot say them now. Consider them said, he thought. I'll say them later. Just then he felt a sudden banging and jerking on the line he held with his two hands. It was sharp and hard feeling and heavy. He is hitting the wire leader with his spear, he thought. That was bound to come. He had to do that. It may make him jump, though, and I would rather he stayed circling now. The jumps were necessary for him to take air. But after that, each one can widen the opening of the hook wound, and he can throw the hook. Don't jump, fish, he said. Don't jump. The fish hit the wire several more times, and each time he shook his head, the old man gave up a little line. I must hold his pain where it is, he thought. Mine does not matter. I can control mine, but his pain could drive him mad.
This ends Disc 2. The Old Man and the Sea, Disc 3.
After a while, the fish stopped beating at the wire and started circling slowly again. The old man was gaining line steadily now, but he felt faint again. He lifted some seawater with his left hand and put it on his head. Then he put more on and rubbed the back of his neck. I have no cramps, he said. They'll be up soon and I can last. You have to last. Don't even speak of it. He kneeled against the bow and for a moment slipped the line over his back again. I'll rest now while he goes out in the circle, and then stand up and work on him when he comes in, he decided. It was a great temptation to rest in the bow and let the fish make one circle by himself without recovering any line. But when the strain showed the fish had turned to come toward the boat, the old man rose to his feet and started the pivoting and the weaving pulling that brought in all the line he gained. I'm tireder than I have ever been, he thought, and now the trade wind is rising. but that will be good to take him in with. I need that badly. I'll rest on the next turn as he goes out, he said. I feel much better. Then in two or three turns more, I will have him. His straw hat was fire on the back of his head, and he sank down into the bow with the pull of the line as he felt the fish turn. You work now, fish, he thought. I'll take you at the turn. The sea had risen considerably, but it was a fair-weather breeze, and he had to have it to get home. I'll just steer south and west, he said. A man is never lost at sea, and it is a long island. It was on the third turn that he saw the fish first. He saw him first as a dark shadow that took so long to pass under the boat that he could not believe its length. No, he said. He can't be that big. But he was that big. And at the end of this circle he came to the surface only 30 yards away, and the man saw his tail out of the water. It was higher than a big scythe blade, and a very pale lavender above the dark blue water. It raked back, and as the fish swam just below the surface, the old man could see his huge bulk and the purple stripes that banded him. His dorsal fin was down, and his huge pectorals were spread wide. On this circle, the old man could see the fish's eye, and two gray sucking fish that swam around him. Sometimes they attached themselves to him. Sometimes they darted off. Sometimes they would swim easily in his shadow. They were each over 3 feet long, and when they swam fast, they lashed their whole bodies like eels. The old man was sweating now, but from something else besides the sun. On each calm, placid turn the fish made, he was gaining line, and he was sure that in 2 turns more he would have a chance to get a harpoon in. But I must get him close. Close. Close, he thought. I mustn't try for the head. I must get the heart. Be calm and strong, old man, he said. On the next circle the fish's back was out, but he was a little too far from the boat. On the next circle he was still too far away, but he was higher out of the water, and the old man was sure that by gaining some more line he could have him alongside. He had rigged his harpoon long before, and its coil of light rope was in a round basket, and the end was made fast to the bit in the bow. The fish was coming in on his circle now, calm and beautiful-looking, and only his great tail moving. The old man pulled on him all that he could to bring him closer. For just a moment the fish turned a little on his side. Then he straightened himself and began another circle. I moved him, the old man said. I moved him then. He felt faint again now, but he held on the great fish all the strain that he could. I moved him, he thought. Maybe this time I can get him over. Pull hands, he thought. Hold up legs. Last for me, head. Last for me. You never went. This time I'll pull him over. But when he put all of his effort on, starting it well out before the fish came alongside and pulling with all his strength, the fish pulled partway over and then righted himself and swam away. Fish, the old man said. Fish, you are going to have to die anyway. Do you have to kill me too? That way nothing is accomplished, he thought. His mouth was too dry to speak, but he could not reach for the water now. I must get him alongside this time, he thought. I am not good for many more turns. Yes, you are, he told himself. You're good forever. On the next turn he nearly had him, but again the fish righted himself and swam slowly away. You are killing me, fish, the old man thought. But you have a right to. Never have I seen a greater or more beautiful or a calmer or more noble thing than you, brother. Come on and kill me. I do not care who kills who. Now you are getting confused in the head, he thought. You must keep your head clear. Keep your head clear and know how to suffer like a man. Or a fish, he thought. Clear up, head, he said in a voice he could hardly hear. Clear up. Twice more it was the same on the turns. I do not know, the old man thought. He had been on the point of feeling himself go each time. I do not know. But I will try it once more. He tried it once more, and he felt himself going when he turned the fish. The fish righted himself and swam off again slowly with the great tail weaving in the air. I'll try it again, the old man promised, although his hands were mushy now and he could only see well in flashes. He tried it again, and it was the same. So he thought, and he felt himself going before he started, I will try it once again. He took all his pain and what was left of his strength and his long-gone pride, and he put it against the fish's agony, and the fish came over onto his side and swam gently on his side, his bill almost touching the planking of the skiff, and started to pass the boat, long, deep, wide, silver and barred with purple, and interminable in the water. The old man dropped the line and put his foot on it, and lifted the harpoon as high as he could, and drove it down with all his strength and more strength he had just summoned, into the fish's side just behind the great chest fin that rose high in the air to the altitude of the man's chest. He felt the iron go in, and he leaned on it, and drove it further, and then pushed all his weight after it. Then the fish came alive with his death in him, and rose high out of the water, showing all his great length and width and all his power and his beauty. He seemed to hang in the air above the old man in the skiff. Then he fell into the water with a crash that sent spray over the old man and over all of the skiff. The old man felt faint and sick, and he could not see well. But he cleared the harpoon line and let it run slowly through his raw hands, and when he could see, he saw the fish was on his back with his silver belly up. The shaft of the harpoon was projecting at an angle from the fish's shoulder, and the sea was discoloring with the red of the blood from his heart. First it was dark as a shoal in the blue water that was more than a mile deep. Then it spread like a cloud. The fish was silvery and still and floated with the waves. The old man looked carefully in the glimpse of vision that he had. Then he took two turns of the harpoon line around the bit in the bow and laid his head on his hands. Keep my head clear, he said against the wood of the bow. I am a tired old man, but I have killed this fish, which is my brother, and now I must do the slave work. Now I must prepare the nooses and the rope to lash him alongside, he thought. Even if we were two and swamped her to load him and bailed her out, the skiff would never hold him. I must prepare everything. Then bring him in and lash him well and step the mast and set sail for home. He started to pull the fish in to have him alongside so that he could pass a line through the gills and out his mouth and make his head fast alongside the bow. I want to see him, he thought, and to touch and to feel him. He is my fortune, he thought, but that is not why I wish to feel him. I think I felt his heart, he thought, when I pushed on the harpoon shaft the second time. Bring him in now and make him fast and get the noose around his tail and another around his middle to bind him to the skiff. Get to work, old man, he said. He took a very small drink of water. There is very much slave work to be done now that the fight is over. He looked up at the sky and then out to his fish. He looked at the sun carefully. It is not much more than noon, he thought, and the trade wind is rising. The lines all mean nothing now. The boy and I will splice them when we are home. Come on, fish, he said. But the fish did not come. Instead, he lay there wallowing now in the seas, and the old man pulled the skiff up onto him. When he was even with him and he had the fish's head against the bow, he could not believe his size. But he untied the harpoon rope from the bit, passed it through the fish's gills and out his jaws, made a turn around his sword, and then passed the rope through the other gill, made another turn around the bill, and knotted the double rope and made it fast to the bit in the bow. He cut the rope then and went astern to noose the tail. The fish had turned silver from his original purple and silver, and the stripes showed the same pale violet color as his tail. They were whiter than a man's hand with his fingers spread, and the fish's eye looked as detached as the mirrors in a periscope or as a saint in a procession. It was the only way to kill him, the old man said. He was feeling better since the water, and he knew he would not go away, and his head was clear. He's over 1,500 pounds the way he is, he thought. Maybe much more. If he dresses out 2/3 of that at 30 cents a pound. I need a pencil for that, he said. My head is not that clear. But I think the great DiMaggio would be proud of me today. I had no bone spurs, but the hands in the back hurt truly. I wonder what a bone spur is, he thought. Maybe we have them without knowing it. He made the fish fast to the bow and stern and to the middle thwart. It was so big it was like lashing a much bigger skiff alongside. He cut a piece of line and tied the fish's lower jaw against his bill so his mouth would not open and they could sail as cleanly as possible. Then he stepped the mast, and with the stick that was his gaff and with his boom rigged, the patched sail drew. The boat began to move, and half lying in the stern, he sailed southwest. He did not need a compass to tell him where southwest was. He only needed the feel of the trade wind and the drawing of the sail. I better put a small line out with a spoon on it and try to get something to eat and drink for the moisture. But he could not find a spoon, and his sardines were rotten. So he hooked a patch of yellow gulf weed with his gaff as they passed, and shook it so that the small shrimps that were in it fell onto the planking of the skiff. There were more than a dozen of them, and they jumped and kicked like sand fleas. The old man pinched their heads off with his thumb and forefinger and ate them, chewing up the shells and tails. They were very tiny, but he knew they were nourishing and they tasted good. The old man still had 2 drinks of water in the bottle, and he used half of one after he had eaten the shrimps. The skiff was sailing well, considering the handicaps, and he steered with the tiller under his arm. He could see the fish, and he had only to look at his hands and feel his back against the stern to know that this had truly happened and was not a dream. At one time, when he was feeling so badly toward the end, he had thought perhaps it was a dream. Then, when he had seen the fish come out of the water and hang motionless in the sky before he fell, he was sure that there was some great strangeness, and he could not believe it. Then he could not see well, although now he saw as well as ever. Now he knew there was the fish, and his hands in back were no dream. The hands cure quickly, he thought. I bled them clean, and the salt water will heal them. The dark water of the true gulf is the greatest healer that there is. All I must do now is keep the head clear. The hands have done their work, and we sail well. With his mouth shut and his tail straight up and down, we sail like brothers. Then his head started to become a little unclear, and he thought, is he bringing me in, or am I bringing him in? If I were towing him behind, there would be no question. Nor if the fish were in the skiff, with all dignity gone, there would be no question either. But they were sailing together, lashed side by side, and the old man thought, let him bring me in if it pleases him. I am only better than him through trickery, and he meant me no harm. They sailed well, and the old man soaked his hands in the salt water and tried to keep his head clear. There were high cumulus clouds and enough cirrus above them so that the old man knew the breeze would last all night. The old man looked at the fish constantly to make sure it was true. It was an hour before the first shark hit him. The shark was not an accident. He had come up from deep down in the water as the dark cloud of blood had settled and dispersed in the mild deep sea. He had come up so fast and absolutely without caution that he broke the surface of the blue water and was in the sun. Then he fell back into the sea and picked up the scent and started swimming on the course the skiff and the fish had taken. Sometimes he lost the scent, but he would pick it up again or have just a trace of it. And he swam fast and hard on the course. He was a very big mako shark, built to swim as fast as the fastest fish in the sea, and everything about him was beautiful except his jaws. His back was as blue as a swordfish's, and his belly was silver, and his hide was smooth and handsome. He was built as a swordfish except for his huge jaws, which were tight shut now as he swam fast, just under the surface, with his high dorsal fin knifing through the water without wavering. Inside the closed double lip of his jaws, all of his 8 rows of teeth were slanted inwards. They were not the ordinary pyramid-shaped teeth of most sharks. They were shaped like a man's fingers when they are crisped like claws.
They were nearly as long as the fingers of the old man, and they had razor-sharp cutting edges on both sides. This was a fish built to feed on all the fishes in the sea that were so fast and strong and well-armed that they had no other enemy. Now he speeded up as he smelled the fresher scent, and his blue dorsal fin cut the water. When the old man saw him coming, he knew that this was a shark that had no fear at all and would do exactly what he wished. He prepared the harpoon and made the rope fast while he watched the shark come on. The rope was short, as it lacked what he had cut away to lash the fish. The old man's head was clear and good now, and he was full of resolution, but he had little hope. It was too good to last, he thought. He took one look at the great fish as he watched the shark close in. It might as well have been a dream, he thought. I cannot keep him from hitting me, but maybe I can get him. Then too so, he thought. Bad luck to your mother. The shark closed fast astern, and when he hit the fish, the old man saw his mouth open, and his strange eyes, and the clicking chop of the teeth as he drove forward in the meat just above the tail. The shark's head was out of water, and his back was coming out, and the old man could hear the noise of skin and flesh ripping on the big fish when he rammed the harpoon down onto the shark's head at a spot where the line between his eyes intersected with the line that ran straight back from his nose. There were no such lines. There was only the heavy, sharp blue head and the big eyes and the clicking, thrusting, all-swallowing jaws. But that was the location of the brain, and the old man hit it. He hit it with his blood-mushed hands driving a good harpoon with all his strength. He hit it without hope, but with resolution and complete malignancy. The shark swung over, and the old man saw his eye was not alive, and then he swung over once again, wrapping himself in two loops of the rope. The old man knew that he was dead, but the shark would not accept it. Then, on his back, with his tail lashing and his jaws clicking, the shark plowed over the water as a speedboat does. The water was white where his tail beat it, and three-quarters of his body was clear above the water when the rope came taut, shivered, and then snapped. The shark lay quietly for a while on the surface, and the old man watched him. Then he went down very slowly. "He took about 40 pounds," the old man said aloud. "He took my harpoon, too, and all the rope," he thought. "Now my fish bleeds, and there will be others." He did not like to look at the fish anymore since he had been mutilated. When the fish had been hit, it was as though he himself were hit. "But I killed the shark that hit my fish," he thought, "and he was the biggest entuso that I have ever seen. And God knows that I have seen big ones." It was too good to last, he thought. I wish it had been a dream now, and that I had never hooked the fish, and was alone in bed on the newspapers. "But man is not made for defeat," he said. "A man can be destroyed, but not defeated." "I'm sorry that I killed the fish, though," he thought. "Now the bad time is coming, and I do not even have the harpoon. The dentuso is cruel and able and strong and intelligent, but I was more intelligent than he was." Perhaps not, he thought. "Perhaps I was only better armed." "Don't think, old man," he said aloud. "Sail on this course and take it when it comes." "But I must think," he thought, "because it is all I have left. That and baseball. I wonder how the great DiMaggio would have liked the way I hit him in the brain. It was no great thing," he thought. "Any man could do it. But do you think my hands were as great a handicap as the bone spurs? I cannot know. I never had anything wrong with my heel except the time the stingray stung it when I stepped on him when swimming and paralyzed the lower leg and made the unbearable pain." "Think about something cheerful, old man," he said. "Every minute now you are closer to home. You sail lighter for the loss of 40 pounds. He knew quite well the pattern of what could happen when he reached the inner part of the current. But there was nothing to be done now. "Yes, there is," he said aloud. "I can lash my knife to the butt of one of the oars." So he did that with the tiller under his arm and the sheet of the sail under his foot. "Now," he said, "I am still an old man, but I am not unarmed. The breeze was fresh now, and he sailed on well. He watched only the forward part